welcome to the Toffee Blues, your source for all things Everton, and welcome to another show where, once again, I'm joined by Teddy McAllister, and also a very warm welcome back to the Toffee Blues to Dave Johnston from the Falcon Blues. How are you doing, Dave?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. Thanks very much for having us on.
I think it's my first show. It's my first show as host alongside you, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. It's normally being Jerry. I've not heard from him much, even on Twitter, to be honest with you.
He's doing well with the fact,
Yeah.
It's obviously big shoes for me to fill, at least.
Definitely, mate, yeah.
So obviously tonight we're going to be doing a manager review, and tonight's manager will be the recently departed Marco Silva. After that,
he's not dead.
No, that does sound like he's passed away, the way you said that. The best way to put it would be the recently... I was trying to say it in a nice way, but the recently sacked Marco Silva. I mean, it sounds a lot more harsh, but at least it doesn't sound like he's dead.
And then, sorry, mate, you didn't flow there. Go ahead.
You know what I mean? So, okay, just a quick... We'll just clarify before we move on. Marco Silva is alive and well. After that, we're going to have a transfer segment where we discuss our priorities for the next window, whatever that may be. We'll give our thoughts on a few positions in the team, and we'll finish off with an If You Know Your History Everton quiz. Before we get going on those segments, how are you guys doing? How are you holding up? How are you managing your lockdown?
Yeah, pretty good. So same old, really, until today. I'm back doing some work from home today. First time since the lockdown, so I've been quite lucky to get this far without having to do it. But yeah, it's all right. I'm one of those rare people. I can't work from home. I hate it. I get too easily distracted. I like the mental checkpoint of going into a work building to do work and then checking back out when I leave. But
I agree with that. I'm the same.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, would love to work from home, but I'm one of them. I'm not keen on it, but, you know, needs must. But yeah, other than that, watched a bit of the show Vikings on Amazon Prime. I'd give it a go previously and never kept up with it, and now me and the missus are watching it as we go along each evening, and it's all right. Yeah, I wouldn't, you know, not on to season two. I wouldn't rave over it and go, you need to see it, but it's good. I'm a fan of it. How about you?
Nothing after season two.
I believe so.
They were all done by the History Channel. So once Amazon took it over, it ramps up a little bit more and it gets a lot better.
Yeah. I've heard that from other people. You've literally took the words out of your mouth. When you said it gets better as a season two, I was going to say someone told me that when it switches from History Channel to Amazon, it's the game changes. And so that's, you're the second person who sent that to me. So I'm hoping to get the end of season two boxed off after this show, and then we'll see where we go from there.
Good stuff. Yeah, for me though, I got furloughed back end of March. So at the minute, I'm Mr. Johnston, teacher, and all round dad pretty much at the moment with the two kids, but you know, missus is still working from home full time as well, so it's a bit of a pain in the ass. But I'm basically, as long as the school are giving me work for them to do, you know, I've got to work on printer now, so give them everything they need and then give them a couple of hours, and then you just see one of them running around with the tablet before, so you know, once they got their iPads, they're happy. But apart from that, I'm playing a lot more PlayStation games. Got back into Final Fantasy VII Remake came out, didn't it, last week? Mm-hmm. So straight back into that. Streets of Rage 4 as well on the PlayStation and the Switch. I got it for both because I'm weird like that. I've just been playing it a lot more online on the PlayStation as well. It's so good. I'm really enjoying that for Streets of Rage 4.
Yeah, that's the one thing I've forked out again for PlayStation Plus, so I can play online games. It's been a lot more FIFA been played. It was one of them. It's a game that I've played a hell of a lot of in my lifetime. It's probably,
yeah,
I'd hate to see the amount of hours that I'd spent playing FIFA in my lifetime. But obviously, it's great to be able to play online with my mates again, and then it just keeps you sane, really.
It's got to, hasn't it? So you need something.
What's the Final Fantasy remake like? I played the original, loved it, but I haven't got a PS4 to play the new one. I'm going to get one. It's to get, and that is going to be the first game I get because it does look good, but is it as good as it looks?
It to me, it feels like a bit of a hack and slash game at the moment because it's like it's a button basher, but then you've got that little bit of role play in the middle of it as well. graphically absolutely stunning. Musically, the score to it is incredible, as you would expect it to be, as it's all updated and everything. I'm just, I'm enjoying it. I'm not loving it the way, because I could easily just go back and bounce into Final Fantasy VII on the PS1 now, and just blitz it and just play it for like a day if I want to. This one, I'm like an hour and a half. All right, I'll pack in for a little bit, but it just seems like a boss battle after boss battle. It's not like the way Final Fantasy VII was. It's more like the later Final Fantasy 15 and stuff like that. So it's good. I'm enjoying it, but I think it's going to be hard for them to do more than. I mean, it only goes up to like chapter 18 or something like that, which is just out of Midgar. For all you nerds who are watching, you get out of Midgar and you're on the world map, and then that's when the game is finished. And then it's going to be like another two, but then that is the game. And then it's like the next part of it, which is going to be like disc two and another 60 quid or something, you know, or it's going to be DLC, something like that.
Yeah, well, that's it. You know, the classic downloadable content here, but now it's pay to win, isn't it? Or pay to play even at this stage.
It's crazy. I'm just glad I'm off work and I've got actually a little bit of disposable income. You know what I mean? Just got that little bit of extra cash by not going to work and, you know, spoiling myself and being a teenager again and buying games.
Tell me about it, mate. So obviously we'll move on anyway to the first segment of the show, which is the Marco Silva review, and we'll start with you, Dave. Let's go back to the beginning, the summer of 2018. What was your opinion when Marco Silva was announced as our new manager?
Well, he couldn't have done any worse than Koeman or Allardyce, really, could he? I think you look at it and you go, well, we needed someone in. And we needed someone in fast to steady the ship and get someone in with Marcel Brands. But from the get-go, it was like, I don't want him. I didn't want him as manager of Everton. You know, it wasn't just... It just didn't come from anything that instilled any kind of confidence in me. You know, you look at Koeman, and probably similar, but it was that name and, you know, that recognisable name with Ronald Koeman. You can go, well, hang on. It's Ronald Koeman. It's not... Well, it was Marco Silva, and you know, the 48 games in the English football to then come to Everton, that's not an Everton manager to me. And you know, everyone's it's more a case of like, all right, he's here, we got to get on with it and hope that something changes and it's something clicks within Brands. But for me, from the get go, I was like, I don't really want this fella in, but I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt and you know, see where it takes us.
Yeah, I think I was a lot more confident, I think, than you were in him. I think the fact that he was bringing some kind of a more attacking style of play to the team, to obviously what we'd have to witness under Allardyce and to a lesser extent Koeman before that, I thought, whatever it'll be a breath of fresh air. And I think to an extent it was. What did you think, Terry, when Silva was announced?
Well, when we were first linked with Silva, you know, in the early parts of the season before, I wasn't really, you know, struck on him. I didn't dislike him per se, but I thought, well, he's not really done anything. You know, he's done all right with Watford. I didn't hold the Hull spell against them, to be honest, because of the situation he went into. But I was like, you know, I was underwhelmed. I was like, you know, I can see why they want him. He's, you know, they think he's going to be another Pochettino. And when he was at Watford before the wheels came off, he was getting like linked with like, oh, he might go to Chelsea after this. So he was a hot commodity before his form dipped off. But when he actually got appointed, a lot of time had passed between the first link and then, and I had completely changed my opinion at that point. I was like, I hated Allardyce. I hated him. Every press conference, I was just sweating non-stop afterwards, slating him. I couldn't stand him. I couldn't wait for him to be shot at the club and the club could breathe fresh air again. So just like, you know, if you get out of a bad relationship and the next person is not as bad and you're just like over the top with how much you think they're great. I was a bit like that with Silva when he was appointed. I still would have, you know, I was still... You know, you line up, you know, Paulo Fonseca and other managers we were linked with. Silva was still down, you know, my list of candidates, but I was just so happy to have a young, like, fresh, you know, fresh ideas, progressive manager who wants to play attacking football on paper. I was made up. I was like, you know what, I would have preferred someone else, but I just think he's so much better than what Allardyce was. and I was happy for the club to get out of that little spell, because I personally liked Koeman. I thought he, you know, he should have got a bit longer in the job. I'm, you know, no point going over that now. But I was so anti Allardyce that I was just happy to have what I considered to be a proper Everton manager again, in the sense of it wasn't this self-promoting, you know, egomaniac idiot in Sam Allardyce. So I was quite enthusiastic, but with all those like qualifiers.
I think we can speak for a lot of Everton fans in that respect, where I think at that stage we took on this anything but Allardyce mentality. And then, do you think that maybe helped Marco Silva's cause in his early stages as Everton manager, sort of, especially when he first encountered that bad spell in the winter of the first season when we were struggling a bit? Do you think it sort of bought him a bit more time, the whole, at least he's not Sam Allardyce mentality?
Did with me.
Yeah, definitely. I thought so, sorry, said it, go on.
No, I mean, it wasn't right. I look back now and just think I was wrong there. Like, I was giving him benefits of the doubt when he didn't deserve it and he hadn't earned it, but I was just so keen to get a bit of stability and a bit of, like, you know, let's not turn on this manager, let's stick with it, because look what happened last time. That, you know, I think I was a little bit naive and, you know, giving him, you know, chances that he, you know, if we hadn't have had Allardyce before, Andy wouldn't have got.
That's definitely,
yeah, probably say the same. It's just you did give him the benefit of the doubt, even in his press conferences, and, you know, we were thinking goals will come here. We're, you know, we were doing all the great work outside, you know, up leading up to the 18-yard box, and just not having that killer instinct. I suppose that was with having Calvert-Lewin up top a lot. You know, Calvert-Lewin was still finding his feet for the majority of the season, and it sort of hamstrung. Hamstrung Silver a bit. It's like, well, who do I turn to? Do I turn to Umanias? You know, Cenk Tosun wasn't doing anything, and, you know, he did struggle, but it was like, no, goals are going to come. We all sat there and we all said, it's like, we're playing good football, we're just not getting the results. We'll keep chipping at this, and one day we're just going to spank a team and we're just going to go on a run. And, you know, unfortunately, didn't really happen until like the latter stage of the season.
I think what was sort of disappointing, you spoke about his press conferences, I thought his press conferences were really bland. I just couldn't listen to them. I mean, whether you liked Roberto Martinez or not, I could listen to his press conferences and he had a bit more of a charisma, whereas I think Marco Silva was pretty dull, wasn't he? I remember some of his press conferences, like, especially in the pre-season of this season that we're still in now. It's been that long ago now where I almost forget that Silva was the manager at the start of the season. The last 2 months have felt like an eternity, but that's kind of what it was like listening to a Marco Silva press conference.
Yeah, he just mumbled through them all, didn't he? And you know what I mean? Like, that was another thing. It was like, yeah, he doesn't communicate well, but, and everything was always, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but everything was,
he's crap,
it's gonna come off, because there were things you could grasp onto under Silva, because Koeman, his first season, was basically Lukaku, just like hid all the weaknesses, and it's the same, I think Aubameyang's doing it now for Arsenal. I think without Aubameyang, they'd go like we did without Lukaku. But then since Lukaku left, we've had no saving grace in the team at all. There was like no players that anyone liked, and there was no, you know, standout player who was, like, you know, making things bearable. But then eventually, when Silva comes in, he come in with alongside, we had Luca Dean, who was, you know, everyone adored him because he was so good, and like Bernard down the left was, you know, the new Baines Pienaar type thing, and Richarlison was scoring goals. So it came up, you know, Silva came in with like things you could grasp onto as like, you know, positives to say, you know, sort of go, well, look, it's better now because, you know, look at this, look at that. And we say about like, oh, well, he was helped by the, you know, spectre of Allardyce. I think before he went on the run, you know, like before the Cardiff win, which turned things around a lot for Silva, there was like talk, it's happened again since, obviously, that, you know, he's going to go and David Moyes might come in. And I think that was, you know, it wasn't as widely reported as it was this recent time, but there was rumours that David Moyes was spoken to about coming in. And I think, you know, a lot of people were like, nah, just stick with Silva. Even though things aren't great, you don't want to go backwards and just have a repeat of the Allardyce thing where everyone's just disillusioned and everyone's not enthusiastic. And we'll just, you know, we'll just stick with it and see if it comes out the other side.
Yeah, I think there was always, I think we were scarred a bit by the Allardyce era where we didn't want to have that sort of permanent manager but interim manager, if you know what I mean, in the sort of Allardyce sense, which I think David Moyes would have been if we brought him in as well. And obviously we had that same issue when we did sack Silva eventually in December. I think for a long time before Carlo Ancelotti was announced, it was rumoured it was definitely going to be David Moyes for about a week, I think, wasn't it? And I think, which obviously the fans didn't receive well.
I'd have been sick if that had happened. Honest to God, I think if Moyes was to come in, I'd have been done with football. I'd have been done with Everton. Honest to God, that's one cut too many. That was, I mean, you know, you look at Koeman, you look at Allardyce, you look at Silva's tenure. It's death by a thousand cuts. Even going back to Roberto Martinez, you know, you looked at Martinez's style in his first season. It's great attacking, flowing football, pressing, high energy, and then it just went. We're just going to pass it. We're just going to keep passing the ball around, and it was, and we conceded so many goals and lost so many games, and it was death by a thousand cuts. And I think, you know, Moyes would have been the cut across my throat. That'd been done. Honest to God, I don't think I'd have bothered with Everton anymore.
That probably would have finished me off as well. And you know what? It's not even that much. I mean, it is a bit, but it's not even completely a comment on Moyes' ability as a manager. But it's just so depressing, isn't it? The idea. I mean, you want to be excited by your club. You want to be able to get behind it. And I just think some of the bad decisions since. I think Lukaku leaving is probably a good thing, a good timestamp. Since then, the decisions that we've made with regards to recruitment and regards to you know, managers and what have you, they've been so hit and miss that everyone was just so tired of like rolling the dice. And like, no one who would have been enthusiastic about Moyes coming back in. There'd been people who would have thought it was a good move and it was a sensible move, but no one would have been excited, would they? Even this.
Bear in mind, though, that even then, obviously Moyes did a good job at Everton over 11 years there or thereabouts, but it wasn't the same Moyes that was coming back as the one that left us.
No.
He's washed up now. That's...
No, there was no hunger with that Moyes. You look at his time at United, then, you know, his time in Spain wasn't good enough. You know, and then, you know, he bounced around a little bit and ended up at West Ham. And yet, to be fair, he kept West Ham up, but that is literally what he was there to do. You know, to then come to Everton, it's like, listen, you're going to have to turn this around again, but you're going to have to deliver. And I don't think Moyes has that in him anymore. I don't think he's got that fire and that spark that he had during that period where it was backs against the wall for Everton. And, you know, we're the underdogs. All right, let's show them what underdogs are made of. You know what I mean? And there's no fight in Moyes anymore. You can see it when he's on the touchline. He just looks just beaten.
I mean,
They're just on back onto Silva. I do think though, with Silva, I thought for the longest time his biggest problem was the press. Like, he eventually. It was his own, you know, his own football, his own, you know, doing that cost him his job. I'm not suggesting for a second he didn't deserve to go. You know, you could list off a load of things like the away record by itself. The fact that he won like what, one away game or what it was it while he was here or two. It was just atrocious. But he didn't. He needed to be spectacular to counteract the fact that the press hated him because he took Allardyce's job. So. Everyone in the press couldn't wait to stick the knife in on him, and he didn't have the personality to like overcome that. Like, he was so meek and so like withdrawn and sunken into himself, and you know, mumbling. I'm not even saying like it was an English thing; his English was fine. He just had no presence, no gravitas as a manager, which you do need. And the press were just out to get him at every turn. Like, he told. And one of the away games that, you know, we got a result, he told the players to give their shirts to supporters, and idiots like Koundé on TalkSport were going, that's the sign of a desperate manager. what, telling the players to give the away fans the shirt as a desperate manager. He was snake bitten from the minute he got there, and minute he got to Goodison, and he just didn't have it in him. He wasn't a good enough manager or a big enough character to overpower that narrative. And for me, he was on the outs as being an Everton manager this season at the home game for Spurs when the horrid injury for Andre Gomes happened. And he was just so meek. He just, you know, like afterwards, I don't even mean around the injury, but that game, the penalty decision we didn't get,
he was too timid. He was too respectful of the officials who, if you'd asked me, I thought he was too soft on the players. I thought if the referee had took more of a hold on that game, then perhaps the tackle that led to the injury doesn't happen in the first place. I think if the referee controls the game more, obviously Spurs were practically refereeing the game because we weren't getting in the faces enough.
Well, yeah, exactly. We need, I think, an Everton manager should be combative because the fans are combative. Look at Goodison when it's snarling, when it's nasty. You need a manager that embodies that. You don't need a hothead manager who starts, you know, gets himself sent off all the time. But case in point, Carlo Ancelotti is one of the most decorated managers, most calm and collected managers in world football. But you know, when that decision went against us at Man United at the end, what did he do? Straight on the pitch.
Right in the ref's face, love it.
Right in the ref's face. Honest to God, that was where Marco Silva, I think, ultimately went wrong. I think we could have got past the football and you know, would have improved, and you know, and we could have lived with a lot of the other negatives if his personality would have been a better fit with supporters. Like, I would never have dreamed Ancelotti would be a bombastic, fire in the belly type manager, but he clearly is. Like, he is when he needs to be, and that's why Everton fans have talked to him so much. It's not just about the, you know, the success that does help, but if he hadn't, even if he'd have had all that success, we just didn't, you know, fit the fans, you wouldn't have that sort of connection with him. And he's only been here 5 minutes, and we've already got well more of a link with him than we have ever had with Marco Silva, and he was here for 18 months.
I think it's worth remembering, though, you just said, like, obviously, you didn't think he had that fight. I think all the top managers have everything in them to be what they need to be when they need to be. It's that, and I think he talks about that in his book, doesn't he? About his decisiveness, that he knows when to be angry, when to be reserved. And I think Marco Silva was very monotonous in the sense that he was constantly too quiet, too like meek, quite sulky. I think he just sucked it up a bit too much as well. And obviously he was getting pelters off the press, like you say. I think it all just come down on top of him, didn't it? Like a ton of bricks.
I think apart from that as well, I just think it's just, he almost come across as a bit stubborn as well. Not just like, you know, like as you're saying, he's very monotonous, but also a very stubborn person. Like, you know, this is how I'm going to do it. This is how I'm going to set it out. I'm not going to change my ways or anything like that. And you just think, mate, just fucking take Sigurdsson off. For once.
Scrap the 4-3, the 4-2-3-1. I despise that formation with a passion. I mean, obviously, we saw it was the downfall of Roberto Martinez in the first place. I think he was too slow to change things, and that saw him out the door. I mean, obviously, with Marco Silva, I think it was 10 times worse. I think the rot set in so much quicker than it did with Martinez, which says it all, really, because obviously it was pretty diabolical towards the end of the Martinez era. But Silva pretty much lost the dressing room a lot quicker, I think, didn't he?
I think thinking about when I wrote this down before, because we're thinking about Silva and everything as well, he lost the majority of his midfield. And you know, you look at there's different things that sort of went towards his downfall. Because you look at, like, you know, the Brighton defeat, you know, the last minute penalty or last minute goal, you know, the penalty that wasn't, and he went back and said actually it wasn't a penalty and stuff like that. You know, we never really recovered from the Derby defeat in the last minute, and we took that into the new year, and we took that excuse for quite a while. And he kept using that excuse to say, like, oh, well, listen, we still haven't recovered from getting beat by in the derby.
That's like, pathetic to use.
It is. It's those little things. It's that attitude that he had. But then, you know, you look at it, he lost Andre Gomez. He lost Gbamon within, you know, an hour. Of, you know, and his leg fell off and he's not been the same. And losing to Trezeguet as well, who you don't bank on Gbamon's leg falling off. When you've replaced them from, you know, after selling to Trezeguet, and you know, losing that midfield, that's an engine, that we couldn't recover from that. I think as well, you know,
even with Ancelotti in charge, I don't think we've recovered from that. You can't.
No.
You can't when you don't have the personnel required to do it.
No. This is the it, though. He was all the injuries, all last minute, like, you know, goals and the decisions he had in the two seasons he was here. He had loads of decisions incorrectly go against him. He was a very unlucky manager, and you can't have that if you're in an unlucky club, which we are. You can't have an unlucky manager because it just compounds and stacks on top of each other.
But I wallowed in it as well.
Yeah.
He didn't.
Allardyce.
He didn't stand up to it. Allardyce, to be fair to him, was a lot more like in the press's face, if you ask me.
Prickly, yeah. He was fighting the supporters rather than the press. But the thing, my point was going to be about Allardyce then, and this is a damning thing of Silver, is that Allardyce is one of his go-to lines about, you know, when he's asked usually on TalkSport about you know, his time at Everton. He always says, well, I didn't have the players. I only brought in two players and, you know, they brought in all those players.
Neither of them would.
Ancelotti's got the same squad that Silver had when we were atrocious. Duncan Ferguson had the same squad that Ancelotti, that Silver's had. Marco Silva had Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin, both there, both fully fit. If he'd have just been less stubborn, as Dave said, he could have easily done what Ferguson and then subsequently Ancelotti have done. Put the two of them up front and adjust the team accordingly and play around that winning combination which we've got. You know, you can't say like, oh well, you know, imagine, you know, if someone were to turn around and say, well, you know, Silva didn't have Richarlison all season, but Ancelotti has. No, he had those players. It's not like Ancelotti suddenly playing and he's got Gbamon back, and you know, Gomez has only just been back 5 minutes, so he hasn't really used him properly yet. Same resources, but a much better manager, and even a much less experienced manager in Ferguson saw what needed to be done. Very simple changes, play to the strength of the players you've got and make the most of it. And Silva's just like, no, we're playing this, and that's all we're playing, come hell or high water.
I always wonder why these managers are the way they are, because it's not just, I mean, we've had far too many of these kind of managers, and even David Moyes for me was one of them. He was too stuck in his ways at times as well, no matter how well a job you think he did. But it goes for clubs, loads of clubs in the bottom half of the table, and I find those kind of managers at that level are just too stubborn and refuse to change their ways, and it costs so many of them the jobs, and you wonder, like, when does the penny drop?
You wonder if it's, you know, as you said there, you know, they're stuck in their ways. Do that, it goes, you look at Silver as well. Does that manager have a plan B? And if that plan B doesn't work, does he have a plan C? And that, for me, we've not had it. And all these managers that come in and show it, you know, you look at Everton for the prime example, obviously. You look at Silver's style, which was a lot of passing, a lot of high pace. But it didn't amount to anything. And it's like, well, listen, as Terry's just alluded to then, you play to the strengths of your strikers, which we didn't do. You know, we started pushing Calvert-Lewin out wide and, you know, making him go win headers on the wing and then try and do everything else. You know, Ancelotti's seen that and go, listen, lad, just go and play in the middle. Don't play in the middle of the park. Wait for the ball to come. Do what you need to do and win the ball where you need to, but be in that central position. And he's changed Calvert-Lewin's game around to, you know what, 15 goal season striker so far. And, you know, but it's not massive changes. It's simple. Listen, go and do that. Go and do your job as a striker. Go and do your job as a winger. And it's working. And it's a stubbornness, yeah. But it's also, I don't know how to get myself out of this any other way. I'm going to stick to what I've got and hopefully something sticks.
Just in a quick defence, though, of, well, not just Silva, but like other managers like that, I think it may be a confidence thing because, you know, if this 4-4-2 was to suddenly stop working and Ancelotti just decides he's going to change it up, everyone had just given the time and the benefits of the doubt over that because he's Carlo Ancelotti. Silva started tinkering with the formation. Yeah, eventually everyone would have been made up because we were telling him to. But if he'd have done that further back down the line and it still wasn't working, you know, he'd get a level at him. Like, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's changing formation every week. And that is a valid criticism of some managers. But I think it may just be a confidence thing. These managers know that they're only, you know, 4 or 5 defeats away from the sack. So they're just terrified of changing things in case they're perceived as being, you know, unsure of themselves.
It's a good point. I mean, the managerial climate is the way it is in the Premier League and has been for a good 10, 15 years, to be honest. It's not really what you want to see, but it is what it is. And obviously, managers seem to understand that. And obviously, they get rewarded handsomely for their sackings, unfortunately, and far too handsomely as far as Everton are concerned with the likes of Martinez, Koeman, and of course, Silva now. I think, is that always an issue, do you think, with Everton? Of course, obviously, the FFP side of things. And obviously, we want to keep as much money for the coffers for transfers. We don't want to be constantly paying off managers to be sacked. I know that was another big question mark against should we sack Silva when the rot set in at the start of the season.
I think Silva was probably set up contract-wise to make it a little bit easier to sack him. Not to say that it would, you know, it's easy to sack anyone financially. You've got to pay them out. But I think the lessons were learned from Martinez and Koeman. I don't know. Well, I say lessons were learned. I think he only got a 3-year contract, didn't he? So he was the shortest contract of any of our, you know, like, not including Allardyce, any of the 3 permanent managers in recent years of Silva, Koeman and Martinez. Now, obviously, we've gone back on that and give Ancelotti a massive long-term contract. But I think that was, you know, part of how you'd attract him. You're not going to give him a 3-year contract, are you?
But I think it's a confidence thing again. I think the board know that, you know, Ancelotti is one of the best managers in the world. The fans aren't going to turn on Carlo Ancelotti. They'll turn on every member of the playing squad before they turn on Carlo Ancelotti, if you ask me.
Yeah, true. I mean, it's one of them. Like, you can never guarantee anything, but you just hope that you eventually land on that. I land on the right man in charge, because we've gone from a club that didn't sack managers to being one that regularly sack managers. And Silva, for my money, needs to be the last one we sack for a long time. We don't want to get that reputation of being a merry-go-round club, and I think we're verging on it, even if we're not already on it. But Ancelotti, I think, has got the best chance, just because he will have, just from his reputation, the confidence of supporters, because he's the first. Well, yeah, apart from arguably Koeman, because he'd had some success at Valencia, but he's the first.
I'll be honest, I don't think many Valencia fans will agree with you on that. I know he won a cup, but he nearly took them down.
Well, on paper, if not in practice, but Ancelotti is certainly the first for a very long time, proven track record top manager we brought in. Like, we've had managers in the past who've come good, like Moyes, and we've had managers who've come in who didn't come good, like pretty much everyone else. Ancelotti, whether he's good or not, he's the only one we've had who supports us and just go, can't really say he doesn't know what he's doing. If he's having a bad spell, people will be confident that it is a spell, in my opinion.
That's the perfect way of describing the situation, because Ancelotti, I think I've spoken to a lot of fans, especially ones who saw the glory days and say this club's bigger than maybe what it's perceived to be, and people say we need a manager who represents the level that this club wants to be at, and this is certainly the first manager that we've had who certainly represents that sort of calibre that the club aspires to be, because all the others have been at best upper mid-table managers, and of course I think that's what Marco Silva was at best. I'd say, just to finish off, what would you say Marco Silva's legacy is at Everton?
That 10-game run towards the end of last season, where, you know, we beat Chelsea, United and Arsenal. You know, and it all started sort of with the 0-0 at Liverpool, the Red Shirt, which stopped them from winning the league. So he's got that going for him a little bit. But you know, obviously those three games. The one thing that always gets me with that is that Fulham game where you could literally have put your house on it that we weren't going to win against Fulham. I mean,
because we beat all the teams.
Yeah, we beat everyone else. I think we beat Chelsea, United, and Arsenal, and then we stumbled against Fulham away, and it's like, how the fuck do you do that?
It's vintage Everton, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it just typified Silva though as well. You know, he can turn it on when he needs to.
Already relegated as well, Fulham.
They weren't even fighting for the lives, really. They were already like,
they're already down.
If you know what I mean.
Mitrovic just bullied Jagielka in his 40s.
Oh God, that was it. It was Jagielka's game. Jagielka had come back against Arsenal, hadn't he? Scored the winner. And then he goes, oh, we'll just carry on playing him. What are you doing?
Yeah, again, that was another thing about Silva. I think his decision making, obviously, I think he made the wrong decision too often, and I think that's really sort of sunk him.
Yeah, just on the question of his legacy, he'll be looked back on now, considering, I mean, he can only do this if we go on to be better without him, but I'm pretty sure we will. But he'll be looked back on like Mike Walker. He'll be seen as one of the worst, you know, pound for pound ever managers, one of the poor ones. But he will be, his positive legacy will be his role in bringing Richarlison. That'll be his. Like, he was crucial to bringing Richarlison, who went on to be one of our top players and went on to be a top player, whether we sell him for a lot of money or whether he stays around for a while like Lukaku did. It'll be poor manager was crucial to bringing in one of our key players in the Premier League era, because I think that's how far Richarlison's going to go.
That's a fantastic point, and I think a really good way to end the segment. I think Richarlison is Silva's legacy, even if Silva didn't perform well. He's brought in one of our best players for many a year.
Yeah, fair enough, yeah.
But obviously, as far as Marco Silva goes, between the three of us, it's been a sort of disapproval more than anything else.
Yeah. I mean, that Martinez didn't perform, had a spell where he was good, but his lasting legacy was he brought Lukaku to the club. Silva will be the same.
I mean, again, great players, but it's just one player, and the manager oversaw underperformance. And I think we can.
Onwards.
And unfortunately, I think it's far too regular that we say that about managers, and obviously the amount that we've sacked. But I think it's safe to say we can agree on Marco Silva, his legacy as an actual manager was underperformance.
Yeah.
Right, so there you go. Of course, at this stage, we can't say when the next window will be, but when it does open, Everton will no doubt want to continue the rebuilding job that's needed here, and we will want to strengthen a few areas. Now, the financial impact of the coronavirus crisis and the lockdown may mean the purse strings need to be tightened a bit, and there may be less new arrivals than we might desire. So the question we're posing in this show is, if we have to restrict our transfers to just the one or two in the summer, which positions do we place as the highest priority? We'll start with the Falcon Blue Zone. Dave, where do you think needs to be strengthened the most in Everton's first 11 right now?
Centre-back. I think for me, you know, you look at the progress of Mason Holgate and how well he's done. You know, he had a spell under the... under Koeman, wasn't it, where he was playing at right back. Played quite well, struggled, you know, he was in and out a little bit, and you know, you look at the lad and you go, he's not a right back, he's a centre half. And as I said, you see the progress that he's made, and it's like, that's what he was bought to do. You know, you look at him and John Stones with the two, I don't know, something in the water in Barnsley or something that does something to centre-half, but the pair of them are just absolutely fantastic centre-halves. I know John Stones has struggling as of late, you know, in that City side and not getting much of a game, but you know he's capable of doing something. And I think Mason Holgate has finally stepped up himself and gone, right, this is my chance to be the centre-half at Everton and to prove that I can actually compete in this Premier League. Playing alongside Yerry Mina has been, you know, Mina struggled as well and then has flourished and then has gone on and, you know, he's had his injuries, which we all know of when he first came in. And then you look at Michael Keane and you think, where's the weak link? And I think it's Michael Keane for me. And I don't think he's stepped up to what he could have been as well. I think, you know, when we got him from Burnley, it was like, fucking hell, we're paying 25 million for Michael Keane. United's are keen on him. And it's like, well, where was this Michael? What happened to the Michael Keane of playing alongside Ben Mee? As of that at Burnley, to what we've got now. And it just seems like he's gone back so much in his career, not in his career, but, you know, in the way he's playing lately, that he is down the pecking order at Everton. So for me, a centre-half is my first and foremost, because, you know, defence wins games. You know, defence wins a game every time. Doesn't matter. You know, to me, I'm a defender to play right-back, and I will run and run and run. But I'll work hard for, you know, defensively. And I think that's what we need, just someone else just in that defence. A bit like in the Jagielka mould, bit of pace, bit of guile, you know, talking, plenty of shouting. We've just lacked that, I think, for a while. And I think a centre-half is something that we need first and foremost. Then maybe move into, maybe looking at like centre midfields and stuff like that. But for me at the moment, centre-back, definitely.
Any recommendations? If we had to pick anybody, who would you go with in that centre-half role, if you had to name off the top of your head?
I think for someone, and I'll probably get shot down for this, but just someone who knows the league, someone like Chris Smalling.
Oof. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure I will. That'll go down.
That's what I'm saying. I'm going to get hung out to dry on this one. But it's a player who knows the league, understands, you know, what it's like to win with United and stuff like that, and is now doing well over at Roma. It's like, well, hang on, he knows the league. He just slots in straight away. Even if it's that just, you know, an 18-month gap where it's like, okay, let's solidify the centre-backs. And then you've got, you know, Luca Dean, fully fit. And you've got, you know, either John Joe Kenny, Seamus Coleman, whoever that might be, at right back. And you've got a choice then of, you know, Keane, Smalling, you've got Yerry Mina, and you've got Mason Holgate. Zombies trying to get in the door. And, you know, it just having more than three centre-backs and having the choice of, you know, you can rotate it, you can play two at a time at any time you want. And, you know, smaller maybe, and if the money's there, then, you know, it looks like, it'd be suggesting someone like Koulibaly from Napoli because of Ancelotti's tenure at Napoli. You're going, all right, well, let's go and get him instead because, you know, he's a fantastic player and the money's there, let's do it. But, you know, I think Smalling is one of those players who can just fit into that mould quickly and solidify the defence where we need to. But I'm probably going to get hung out to dry for that one anyway.
I mean, I'll be honest, it's not one I'd agree with personally. But, Terry, what about you? What position would you strengthen?
I was thinking about this before we came on. It's a hard one because there's like a lot of... In an ideal world, we need... You know, we'd like to improve about five positions. Like, let's be honest, you know, centre back, centre midfield, right back. I do think, though, that it probably is a reality that, you know, we might see no transfers, even, you know, given the uncertainty of finances with the, you know, with COVID-19. And, you know, we've posted massive losses, haven't we? And you know, we've still got a lot of professionals on the books, you know, who are taking a wage. And, like, even ones you forgot about, like, you know, Matthew Pennington and players like that. And, you know, there's the obvious ones like Sandro and Bolasie. And, you know, obviously a lot of these players are going to end up going on free transfers, like Nias Martina, probably Mo Bezic and so on. But I think it might be prudent for a summer or a spell where you just sort of, you know, try and save money rather than spend it. But if we were to bring in a player in one position, I'd go for right midfield. Now, it's a strange one, that, because I think the most urgent place in the team that needs improvement is centre midfield, like on a first team basis. But I've done it by basically topping up what players we've got in each position and seeing, you know, what the strength and depth is there. Now, we do need improvement at right back, but we have got, in where, you know, if in a doomsday scenario, we've already got Kenny and Coleman. Would we like better? Yeah, probably, but we've got two. We've got centre backs. We've got centre midfielders. We've still got a centre midfielder we've barely used. Like, for example, there's nothing to say that Gbamon doesn't come back in, at, you know, when his injury is completely healed up, and then he forms a partnership with Andre Gomez. And then we're all right from there. Like, obviously, I don't think the depth's very good. You know, Delph and Schneider and Sigurdsson. But there are players in. There's groups of players there. Whereas Walcott, I don't think Walcott is that good in the first place. But he's certainly the first, you know, first choice on the right. And then after that, what have you got? It won't
also,
be. And he's...
I don't think Walcott is suited to a right mid position in a 4-4-2 either. He's not. He's never been a good crosser of the ball to put the service in for strikers, which you kind of need from your wide players in a 4-4-2.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. In Carlo's 4-4-2, basically, the right midfielder is like the third attacker, whereas the left midfielder is like the number 10 he tucks in. And, like, you know, yeah, there's loads of positions where, you know, the quality isn't quite up to, like, you know, top six standards. But we've got players who can play those positions who are passable. You know, we Kenny and Coleman, you've got Iwobi and Bernard. And whereas on the right, you've got Walcott and then nobody. Maybe Iwobi, and he's terrible on that side. And I think if you really want, if you were going to improve the team immediately with one position, if you'd only bought one, I think the money would probably be best spent on that right midfield to make that third attacker alongside your other two best players, which is Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison, because the left-hand side, it's going to be Dean, isn't it, with a tucked-in playmaker. And Walcott, as look at the goal against Norwich away. Not Norwich, sorry, my mistake. Watford away, the last-minute winner. It literally goes Richarlison, Keane, who just come on, and then Walcott, the three-pronged attack of the two strikers and the right midfield. And I would like to see an improvement in that position. Obviously, there's other positions as well, but if you'd only made one, I think that's the most crucial one. Get that third man in the attacking trio with Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison. I think that makes us really potent.
That's a really good idea. And obviously, there's so many names out there. Who would you go for if you are, like, obviously a realistic one, but if you had a choice, a right mid addition for the team?
I mean, I don't know about realistic because of prices and, you know, what have you. But I like David Neres. He might not have the work rate for this league. It's got to be said. When we were linked with him, I've started watching him and, you know, watched him in the Ajax's run last season. He's not, you know, he's not Richarlison.
He's not a grafter, is he?
No, he's not. But I do like him. I think he would be a good fit in that, you know, three-man attack type thing, that, you know, with the two strikers. There's obviously other names we've been linked with, you know, like Cengiz Under and all that, but I can't really speak to them because I've not watched them. But, yeah, I like David Neres. I think, you know, he would be a good addition, but it just depends as well. Last time we were linked with him, it was a lot of agent talk, obviously, but it was £40 million moves and what have you. Like, I know that'll come down now as everyone starts to look to, you know, sell players to recoup some money after the crisis, but I don't know. David Neres.
Is it an interesting one? Obviously, I think we speak about a lot of these wingers that we're linked with. A lot of them don't seem to have played in a 4-4-2 system, and it's always interesting to see how players can adapt. Is there any... The one that always stands out for me, I mean... Again, it might not be the big name of a Neres or anybody, but obviously this is a shout-out to our own Ben Crawford here and Dwight McNeil. I think because he's played in a 4-4-2, and I'm not saying he's the best option, like, ability-wise or anything, but I'm just thinking to fit the system. Or is the best way to go about it to fit the system or to bring in a better player and tailor the system to him?
I mean, I don't know. It could, this transfer window, when it does happen, it's going to be a strange one because some clubs will really, really do well out of it, you know, because majority of other clubs are going to be looking to sell at reduced rates to just get their books in order. Now, Everton, I don't see on the face of it as being one of those clubs who are going to go, right, we're going to go and spend loads of money, you know, because we've, as I said before, had a lot of losses and what have you, and we're, you know, looking unhealthy and financial fair play. But there's nothing to say that the financial fair play doesn't get relaxed and then, you know, Uzbek, you know, sugar daddy doesn't, like, go, right, well, we're going to sort out.
This is the moment to seize the opportunity, really.
It might be pie in the sky stuff. It might be, you know, you're joking, aren't you? It doesn't work like that. But if we were to suddenly get our ducks in a row financially and FFP was to be relaxed, we'd be out there. We could feasibly go out and get a few players and knock down prices. You know, like players like Ibrahim Sangare, he's been linked and he's going to be going for a lot less than he would have done because Toulouse have just been relegated. And there'd be clubs, especially in Holland and the likes of that, the smaller leagues, who are going to go, right, we need to sell these players now. We need to get the, but on the other hand, you know, we might be one of those clubs as well who go, we need to sell, we don't need to buy. So it just depends. If you're cash rich, you can do really well out of this market. But if you're not, which currently we are not, it might be a time to just, like, you know, be a bit more frugal and just tighten the belt and come back next time and try again.
I think it'd just be interesting to see what happens with the free with the players who are out of contract with Everton as well. You know, I mean, obviously, one of the things we were particularly looking at earlier in the season, January, February, was like, well, hang on, Niasse's out of contract, Sandro's coming out of contract, Bolasie's coming out of contract. There's, you know, 300 grand's worth of wages being freed up a week. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, well, hang on, we've actually got the money to spend it, and now all of a sudden we're, you know, the world's gone upside down. It's like, well, do we look to keep these players because we can't get the players in that we want and utilize them?
I think, you know, to be honest, Dave, I think I've got my own answer to that question. Absolutely not.
It's a resounding no. Of course, no, it is. But
I'd rather see some of the kids have a go than even think of hanging on to those kind of players on those kind of salaries. Yeah. It's just financial suicide, especially given the circumstances Teddy says about.
Well, we can assume safely that all the players who are out of contract, like Martina and Nias and you know, who have you, they're going to be released. But there's quite a lot who are going into there last year. And I think a big thing in this market will probably be loans as well. So even though that's what we've been doing anyway, by loaning out these Deadwood players until their contracts expire, just to get some of their wages at least off the books, I certainly can't see, you know, in an ideal world, the likes of Bolasie coming back in and having a, you know, or we get a fresh go at Everton with 1 year on his contract at his age. I just don't see it. Even under these circumstances, I think they'd just rather do without. But I do think that all the players who are out of contract will just be released, and all the players with 1 year on their contract will be available to loan. And that might be the case for incomings as well. It could be a case of you see more two-year loans, you see cases of players who you'd be interested in. Not so much as many young players, like, for example, Gabriel. I couldn't see us loaning him and then buying him next time when finances are all right. But we've been linked with James Rodriguez, and if we were to shed enough wages, I think he could be a realistic shout for someone to come in, because but they're not going to sell them. Madrid and all these clubs, they will need to sell as well, and they're not going to get buyers for these players. But if they can get them on loan for the remainder of their contract, just like we might do with Bolasie, they might, you know, obviously on a higher up the ladder scale, they might do take the same thing, go, you know what, he's on 280 grand a week, but Everton are offering to do 180 of that. Go on, off you go, because it's saving us money. And it could be a case of that just all the way around the leagues, apart from particularly cash rich clubs like the Man United's.
It's an interesting take. If James Rodriguez was to come in, could he be the answer at right mid as an inverted winger?
I don't know, he doesn't play right midfield, does he? He plays number 10, doesn't he? Maybe in a 4-4-2, you know, like, he might find a place, but I don't.
He's basically Sigurdsson's replacement, isn't he? He's that kind of player.
Or maybe he'd go into that Bernard Iwobi inside left role where he's sort of like, he's out wide nominally, but he's cutting in with a full-back going past him. Like, I couldn't see him being the third, you know, the right-hand side. The right-hand side's like a wide player who goes up high and wide, isn't it?
Possibly.
Yeah, I think you'd have to find a buyer for one of the other players, like a Sigurdsson, like an a Bernard or an Iwobi, which, you know, is probably not going to be popular anyway, to get Rodriguez in. So, I mean, he could come in, but I just don't think we'll be able to shift out players he'd replace. I think we just have another piece of deadwood, like a Sigurdsson, who would, you know, I'd be happy to see him stop playing, but he's not going to go anywhere, is he?
Well, that's it, yeah. I'm not too sure there's too much in the James Rodriguez links, given that he's not, like I say, his preferred position's a number 10, and we don't really have an out-and-out number 10 in this new system. Is it really worth that kind of expenditure on a player who doesn't fit the system?
No, maybe not. But he was really just an example of potential moves that clubs will make of loans for players who they can't sell but they want rid of. We're going to do it, I'm sure. And I'm sure other clubs will. I saw a thing today. I don't think we'd be shopping in this market. But actually, having said that, I think we actually probably will, given our record. But Barcelona have got about 10 centre midfielders. They're going to be looking to loan them out.
What are you thinking? Like an Arturo Vidal or somebody like that?
No one in particular, but I said, I don't think we'll do it because there's no one who fits what we need. But and then I thought, we love buying players from Barcelona. Why would we not be looking at that?
Yeah, that's a good point.
There's loads of clubs like that who are like us, who stockpile players, and half of them don't get a kick of a ball. Now, you know, one man's, you know, rubbish is another man's treasure. So we might look at another club's Schneidlin and he might be well better than what we've currently got. You know what I mean?
So, yeah, to finalise your decision, it'd be a David Neres. That would be your one.
Yeah, we went a bit off point. A little bit off point there, but yeah.
I just realised that.
In this scenario, yes. Given the qualifiers have stated about depth and, you know, bodies and whatnot, I'd go for a right-hand side player who can join up with the strikers, and David Neres would be my pick. There's other players, but I like him the most because I've seen him the most.
Fair play. I think for me personally, I think you guys said name most of the positions, didn't you? Like, obviously, Dave, you said centre-back for your sign and obviously right mid. I'd probably go with the central midfield. I just think we're so threadbare in that position at the moment. And I think we were talking in the Silver Show earlier, weren't we, about how you can't do the job if you don't have the personnel. And obviously, Bannon's returning to fitness. But we could use another kind of workhorse in the middle of that midfield to help us win the sort of physical duels. I feel like we're so pathetic sometimes, Everton in the centre of midfield, winning the big, like, 50-50s. And that can sort of help us gain more possession and maybe have a bit more of an impact on the game. I just think we need another, I feel like, a water carrier, as Eric Cantona once put it about Didier Deschamps. I think we need that sort of player, a player who can throw his weight around in the middle of the park and win the ball back. Maybe in Ibrahim Sangare, as you said before, Terry, I think that's the kind of player we need to add in that midfield. Someone who can really throw his weight around.
We don't really know anything about Gbamon as well. I mean, we've literally seen about 75 minutes of him. And, you know, yeah. When he came on to Palace, he struggled. You know, obviously, the first game in, he was brought on for an injury. And it was like, well, we don't know enough about him to think, well, actually, that, you know, is he Idrissa Gueye's replacement, the player that we wanted, you know, that we're crying out for, really, like you say, with the water carrier, which was literally Idrissa Gueye. You know, the lad would run and just do all the dog work and, you know, leave it to, you know, the likes of Gomez or, you know, to a lesser extent, Schneidlin to do what's needed. Is Gbamon that kind of player? So, yeah, even then, a centre midfield, you know, that kind of
player.
Yeah. And we haven't had that since
But all we know, like, Gbamon could not be suitable for a 4-4-2 either. He could be, like, we've got about 10 centre midfielders, but they all seem to only be able to play in a 3 or only suitable, and, you know, they're not a good fit in a 2. I mean, centre midfield is our most urgent position quality-wise. I definitely agree with that. I just based it on numbers, though. We've got about 10 centre mids and one right midfielder. But in terms of where would improve this team the most if you brought in a new player, it's definitely centre midfield. So we've, who have we got linked with them? Alan? From,
Alan, that'd be an interesting one. I think, depending on the whole wage and transfer situation, like you say, I think he'd be a good addition. Even at, you know, I think he's getting on for 30, but so was Idrissa Gueye, and he was doing a very good job of it. So why not? On a loan, if like you say, if Napoli sanctioned something like that, possibly. But I wouldn't be throwing the whole like checkbook at him. I don't think he's worth that kind of money.
No.
Certainly not.
I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, nobody knows like what the situation's going to be. I mean, not everyone assumes it's going to be worse than it was, which how could it not be? But it, you know, it's just how other clubs are set up and how they're gonna handle it. If any Premier League club can come out of this stable, they're gonna have their pick of a lot of players, like, you know, who have reduced fees and from lesser leagues, just so they can keep them afloat. And I'm talking like, you know, players who probably would have cost 30, 40 million before this are probably going to be going for like 15, 20 now. And but is 15, 20 going to be a prohibitive price? Because it will go back up, you know, when things settle back down, the inflation will go back up again. It's just going to have one summer where if you get it right, you're going to literally make up, you know, a lot of yards on the competition. Just hope that we're one of them who can pull it off.
It's going to be one of them. I think we do need to have a look around, certainly for some bargains. Like I say, we don't even know when the next window is going to be. I keep saying the summer, but will it be the summer? When will the next transfer window be? Obviously, it's such an odd time. We don't know when they're going to sort of, whether they move the goalposts in that respect.
It's awkward, isn't it? I mean, you're hearing stuff saying, oh, they want to resume back in June and stuff like that. Or, you know, as we're talking about before we come on air, like playing in Australia or something like this, like 9,000 miles away, and you know, you can't even go to a funeral at the moment. Do you know what I mean? And you're talking about shipping people 9,000 miles to go and play in Australia, uprooting families again, air travel. You're taking coaches, you're taking the playing staff, you're taking the coaching staff, physios, doctors, and it's just a farce. It's just one thing after another that you just hear and you think, what the hell are you thinking?
But the truth of the matter is, we've got these other leagues. The Netherlands, France have cancelled their leagues. Whether or not they award the title, that's a completely different debate altogether. But why shouldn't we? That's it, precisely.
It's complete money-grabbing exercise. And, you know, it's when the media are pushing it as well. Like soft shite Ollie Holt yesterday.
Oh, for goodness sake. We have to discuss that a little bit before we finish.
You know, you looked at that and you're going, it must be Everton and United fans. Does that mean Everton and United fans are the only ones with an actual working brain of what's going on at the moment? Do you know what I mean? It's like, we probably do sound the most vocal because, yeah, it's our fiercest revival. But, you know, I'm sure if you spoke to someone, you know, a Bournemouth fan or a Norwich fan, it's like, well, we've got other priorities. You know, Norwich are fighting relegation. It's like, well, actually, you know, void the league and we're staying in. Well, you know what I mean?
But at the end of the day, never mind the void the league side of things, just the whole carrying the season on. I think somebody actually replied to this on that tweet that he put out. And you speak to anyone, regardless of even a Liverpool supporter who works in a hospital, and they'll beg to differ.
Yeah. I think a lot of it was a lot of clickbait and everything, but at the same time, you just think, who's coming up with these ideas?
And he loves this points per game idea, which I don't get one bit, to be honest with you. I think it's just, I don't see how
that's just to sort out the games that are in hand. That it'll basically be the table now, but it'll affect the player, you know, the teams who haven't played and. You know, I think everyone else is on 28 and we're on, and most teams are on 28 games and some are on 27. I think the points per game just sorts them out, and then after that, everyone is the same.
So it's basically the league table. Maybe Aston Villa stay up, that's about it.
Yeah,
five of the top six.
It affects majority of well, it affects all the teams who've got a game in hand, but everyone else is practically the same positions. We'd be 12th still. I don't know. It's, I mean, just on Ollie Holt, I blocked that idiot ages ago. I just don't want to see what he has to say. He's the notorious.
The absolute state of that, though. I mean, again, it's a case of a real lack of self-awareness, I think, of obviously what the priorities are. Obviously, this show is about priorities, and we need to, like, basically put it straight that the priority is to get through this as unscathed as we can.
I think, like, someone said something to him today, though, as well, because he's come out with a tweet saying, how can you play, you know, when it's a contact sport and stuff like this. Like, well, hang on.
He said that?
Yeah. Have a look. I don't know the exact tweet, but it was basically coming out saying, oh, well, it's a how can you do this when there's contact with players, you know, the sweat and all this. It's like, we've been trying to tell you this fucking weeks, mate, and you just had to take it in.
Someone replied to the news story of, like, the women's team not wanting to carry the season on, Liverpool's women's team, and someone replied saying they must be all Blues or Manx in that Liverpool women's team.
Fantastic.
Fucking hell. So
obviously, you do see some people's true colours when all this comes out, don't you? You see, like, what... Obviously, I'm not even sure if Ollie Holt's pushing for Liverpool to win the league. Is it? It may well be, like you say, it might be a money situation. Obviously, we've heard a lot of rumours about papers struggling financially as well, and he works for a paper, so, you know, there could be a different kind of agenda that he's pushing, but one way or another, it's not the right agenda to be pushing. Not this moment in time, anyway.
No.
Yeah, we went a little bit off topic there, but of course, on the note of priorities, it was worth remembering that what the priority is to stay safe, basically, and basically come out of this as well as we possibly can. And obviously, moving forward, that is the end of this transfer discussion. But for you lucky podcast listeners, it's, of course, time for the If You Know Your History quiz. Tonight, it's Teddy versus Dave in another Matchday Squad quiz. For those of you who haven't tuned in before, that basically entails me naming an Everton fixture from the past, and our two competitors will take it in turns to reel off the members of the squad, be it a starter or a youth sub who took part in the game. First to get a wrong answer forfeits, and the other is our winner. So first things first, I've actually come prepared this week. I've brought a 2 pence piece. You know what happened the other week with the pen lid, so we're not going to be having a repeat of that. An actual coin to flip. I'm going to flip said coin, and this week I'll let the returning Dave pick whether he wants to go first or not. So heads or tails, Dave?
Heads.
Heads. It's tails. Teddy, do you want to go?
Mate? I'll go second, please.
Teddy's going to go second, so Dave, you're up first, mate. So with all that sorted, I'm going to reveal the fixture in question. So if we cue the intense quiz music, there it is. And in a show that focused heavily on Marco Silva, of course, we're going to hark back to the early stages of his spell in charge for tonight's fixture. And it's probably the best challenge we could serve you from that time. And of course, that fixture is Everton 3, Rotherham United 1, EFL Cup second round, 29th of August, 2018. 14 correct answers to choose from, 11 starters and 3 U subs. Let's do it. You're up first, Dave. You'd like to name a member of the matchday squad?
Stecklenburg.
Martin Stecklenburg was the starting goalkeeper.
That's all I remember.
Hologram game, wasn't it?
It's one of them. I think John's picked an absolutely quality challenge for you, is he? I think this is, like, probably the most forgettable game. I mean, I wish we could forget some of the others, but this is probably the easiest to forget from the Silver Era, arguably, except the fact that I was actually at this game.
Yeah, I was at this game, so I know, because I was watching a particular player to see how he got on. Kieran Dowell.
Kieran Dowell started the game.
Tom Davis.
I think he was the captain that day as well. That's 3 down, Teddy.
Luca Dean.
Luca Dean. He did play. Started the game. Four correct answers in a row. Good start. Dave?
Michael Keane.
Michael Keane did not play. He wasn't even on the bench.
Yeah.
So, that does mean that Terry's our winner after only five answers given. But we'll reel them off anyway, just for a laugh.
Go ahead.
Terry, do you want to give us another name? We've still got another... how many have we got? Another 10 to go.
Kurt Zouma
started the game. 9 to play.
John Joe Kenny
started at right back. 8 left.
Umar Nias
started the game. 7 left.
Schneiderlin
was one of the substitutes. 6 left.
Did Sandro play?
Sandro did play. He started the game and he was the player Schneiderlin replaced.
That's right.
To go.
Let's see.
2 subs and 3 starters.
Richarlison
didn't play.
And not in the squad either.
Wasn't even on the bench.
Gylfi the Ghost, Sigurdsson.
Gylfi the Ghost did play and he scored one of the goals.
Remember them Sigurdsson goals?
Yeah, remember them Sigurdsson playing games? 4 left, 2 starters and 2 subs.
Bernard
didn't play. Wasn't even on the bench.
I'm crap at this. I'll be honest.
Calvert-Lewin
scored the other 2 goals. He played the whole game.
Theo
Walker.
Yep,
he was one of the youth subs. Come on for Sigurdsson, 66th minute.
One sub.
Yeah.
Holgate.
Mason Holgate was the final starter, played centre half next to Kurt Zouma.
Yeah, because he'd said Keane, and I knew that Meaner hadn't played alongside Zouma until Newcastle, so it was either going to be Holgate or Jags.
Yep, so that rounds off the starters, just one sub to go.
It's going to be Yao Silva? Hang on.
I think he was joking,
mate. What's the goalie, the Portuguese goalie we've got?
Yao Virginia.
Virginia, that's the one.
He was an unused sub, but we're looking for the final used sub.
Cheng Tosun.
Correct. That sees us to the end. Cheng Tosun came on for Umar Nias. Shortly after Umar Nias shanked the volley out for a throw-in.
Oh, standard.
so that's the end of all the completed team. The unused substitutes were, as Dave said, Joao Virginia, Matthew Pennington, Seamus Coleman and Leighton Baines. Thank God we didn't have to go to sudden death, because I think we'd have had a hard time guessing. The sudden death question was who scored the one goal for Rotherham.
Forget it.
Fortunately, I remember his name's Will Volks and he's a copite, so he was giving it loads to the park end.
Oh, was he?
Yeah, so he'd done a somersault and then, like, I don't know what he'd done, he just waved in front of the park end, which obviously didn't go down well with the Dars. But of course, with all that out the way, Terry, you won it very early doors there, mate. And again, you get to pick the song that sees us out at the end of this podcast. So if you'd like to tell us what song you'd want us to finish with and tell us a little bit about the song and why you like it, whatnot.
I'm going to go for, it's a cover of A Whole Lot of Love by Led Zeppelin, but the cover is by Carlos Santana and Chris Cornell.
Ooh, hello.
Quite easy to find, and it's just a belter song. Like, I love Led Zeppelin, but the album by Carlos Santana, I think it's just called Santana Guitar Heaven, and it's just Santana doing covers of famous songs with like guest vocalists. Yeah, and Chris Cornell did that one, and there's quite a few like decent ones, like Riders on the Storm with Chester Bennington, but the best one on the album has got to be Whole Lot of Love with Chris Cornell. He was just an amazing singer, Chris Cornell. Like, and this song just really suits him.
Yeah, very good group as well, Soundgarden.
Yeah, he was great. Yeah, I only really got into Chris Cornell like towards the latter part of his career. Like, Audio Slave, Soundgarden, and his own solo stuff. But his solo stuff, he started doing like
he done the Bond thing, didn't he?
Yeah, that was really good.
That's how I came
across it,
to be honest.
That's a really good Bond theme, that one, You Know My Name. But his solo album, he started doing stuff with Timbaland, and it was terrible. Like, it just didn't suit him. It just didn't suit him. Like, I'm not against artists doing different things. You know, like, you don't always have to stick to one thing, and that's it, because that tends to be what a lot of, like, fans want them to do. But if you're going to switch it up, you need to be good at it, you know what I mean? You can't make an absolute pig of an album, that's what he done. But I think that song was on it, and I don't think it was part of the album. I think it was just stuck on it. It was a song he done it, like, one-off. It just sticks out on my game, You Know My Name. But it's, great voice.
That's a great way to finish our show as well. So, of course, thanks for coming on again, Terry, and, of course, our own Falcon Blues very own Dave Johnston, and of course check out the Falcon Blues on Twitter, and check out all the other good stuff they do, like the tours and their pub quiz on the Thursday night, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we should have something hopefully this week. Paul's working, obviously, working for care homes and stuff like that, so he's on the front line doing his bit, so fair play to him. But when he gets a chance, he puts a decent quiz together. He really does.
Is Ollie Holt on Paul's list already?
He went on the list last night when I did a video with Barney and Callum last night, and I put Ollie Holt on there. But I'm going to leave it to Paul to deal with the rest of it and do the actual video of putting him on there. But he definitely made the list yesterday.
I like it.
I want to know what this list is now.
Oh, it's just a list of absolute knobheads. In the world, well, not specific to Everton, was the odd one. It was Everton related, isn't it? But he's just got a list of people he hates.
That's fantastic. So definitely go and check it out.
It's called the Mike Hunt list, and then you'll understand what the list is actually called. Then
I want that. Well, anyway, there you go. Be sure to check out that list as well.
So, he actually got a scroll made, so we could write people's names on there.
A scroll.
With a feather.
It gets serious when there's a scroll involved. Today, thanks for tuning in on the Toppy Blues, and we're going to finish with A Whole Lot of Love by Chris Cornell and Carlos Santana. Thanks for listening. See you later.